and his gaze swung to Coll. Since I walked away from the Malazan Empire and severed once and for all the dubious privileges of my noble blood, damn, I've never felt so alive. It was never a life before, only the palest shadow of what I've now found. Is that a truth most of us are too frightened to face? Coll grunted.
I'm not the sharpest man you'll meet, Paran, and your thoughts are running a touch too deep for me. But if I understand you right, you're sitting there looking at a chopped-up old fool of a man, and you're telling him he's alive. Right now. As alive as can be. And whatever he betrayed back then, it wasn't life, was it?
You tell me, Coll. The man grimaced and ran a hand through his thinning hair.
The thing is, I want it back. I want it all back.
Paran burst out laughing and continued to laugh until sharp pains cramped his stomach. Coll sat watching him, then a low, rumbling chuckle rose from his chest. He reached back, retrieved a handful of sticks, and tossed them into the fire, one at a time.
Well, damn it, Paran, he said,
amused lines crinkling around his eyes.
You've come out of the blue like a godsend bolt of lightning, and I appreciate it. I appreciate it more than you'll ever know.
Paran wiped tears from his eyes.
Hood's breath, he said. Just one war mule talking to another, right? I guess so, Paran. Now, if you'll look in that pack of mine, you'll find a jug of Worrytown wine. Its vintage is about a week.
The captain rose. Meaning?
Meaning it's running out of time.
Book 6. The City of Blue Fire. Rumors like tattered flags, wind-snapped and echoing in the streets below, told the tale of the days upon us. 'Twas said an eel had slipped ashore, or not one but a thousand under a jagged moon that might be dead. 'Twas whispered that a claw scraped slow on the city's cobbles, even as a dragon was seen sailing high silver and black in the night sky. 'Twas heard, they say, a demon's death cry on the rooftops on a night of blood, even as the master's 100 hands lost 100 daggers to the dark. And 'twas rumored then, a lady masked high-born had offered to unbidden guests a fate to remember. Rumor born, Fisher, birth date unknown. Chapter 17. Few can see the dark hand holding aloft the splinter, or the notched chains fated to be heard before death's rattle. But hark the wheel of minions and victims, who moan the Lord's name in the dark heart of moon's spawn. Silver Fox, Outrider Herlakel, 6th Army. As Ralik Nom approached the Phoenix Inn from the alleyway, a large, beefy woman stepped out from a shadowed niche and confronted him. He raised an eyebrow.
You want something, Mies?
Never mind what I want, she grinned invitingly.
You've known about that for years.
Anyway, I come to tell you something, Nom, so relax.
He crossed his arms and waited. Mies glanced back up the alley, then hunched close to the assassin.
There's someone in the bar. Been asking for you. By name.
Startled, Ralik straightened.
What's he look like?
He asked casually.
Like a soldier out of uniform, Mies replied. Never seen him around before. So what do you think, Nom?
He looked away.
Nothing. Where's he sitting?
Mies grinned again.
A crupper's table. Home ground. Now ain't that fine?
Ralik stepped past the woman and headed toward the inn. As she moved to follow, he held out his hand.
A minute between us, Mies, he said, without turning. Where's the realtor?
Inside, she said behind him. Good luck, Nom.
Luck's never free, Ralik muttered, as he turned the corner and climbed the steps. He stood still just within the door and surveyed the crowd. A few strangers, not enough to cause him concern, however. His gaze slid across to a man sitting at Krupa's table. He almost had to take a second look, so nondescript was he. Then Ralik strode straight for him, the crowd parting as he went, something he'd never noticed before. Amused, he held his eyes on the stranger until he was noticed. They locked gazes, though the man made no move other than to take a sip from his tankard, then set it down carefully on the table. Ralik pulled out a chair and dragged it opposite. I'm Ralik Nom. There was something solid about this person, a kind of assurance that was calming. Ralik felt himself relaxing in spite of his habitual caution. The man's first words changed that, however.
The eel has a message for you, he said quietly. Direct. By word of mouth only. Before I deliver it, though, I'm to give you some background, as only I can.
He paused to drink from the tankard, then resumed.
Now, Turbinor has hired another dozen hunters.
What are they hunting?
Well, me, for one. Your problem is that he's going to be harder to reach. The eel approves of your efforts concerning Lady Simtal. Kol's return is desired by all who value integrity and honour within the council. If you require anything, ask now, and it's yours.
Ralik's eyes had hardened. Never knew Murillo had such a big mouth, he said. The man shook his head.
Your compatriot has revealed nothing, nor have you. It is the eel's business. Now, what do you require?
Nothing.
Good.
The stranger nodded, as if he'd expected that reply and was pleased.
Incidentally, Turbinor's efforts to pass the proclamation have been, impeded, indefinitely. The eel wishes to thank you for your unwitting role in that. Nevertheless, the councilman explores other options. He has been watched closely, hence our fortunate discovery that is at the heart of the eel's message to you. Last night, beneath Despot's barbican, Turbinor met with a representative of the Assassin's Guild. How he managed that was quite a feat, considering how difficult your comrades had been to find. In any case, a contract was tendered by Turbinor.
The man waited for the shock to wear off Ralik's face, then continued.
Tendered by Turbinor, as I said, but not on his own behalf. Rather, Lady Simtal has decided that Cole's death should be a fact in the real world, as it is on paper.
Who? Ralik rasped. Who was the contact?
I'm coming to that. First, it was accepted, for the payment was substantial. They are aware that Cole is presently outside Derujistan. They simply await his return.
The assassin's name?
Ocelot.
The man rose.
The eel wishes you success in all your ventures, Ralik Nom. Thus the message ends. Good evening.
He turned to leave.
Wait.
Yes?
Thank you, Ralik said. The stranger smiled, then left. The assassin took the man's seat and leaned against the wall. He waved at Salty, who had a pitcher of ale and a tankard waiting. She hurried over. Behind her strode, at a more leisurely pace, Irilta and Mies. They sat down without preamble, each with her own tankard.
Everybody's still breathing, Irilta said, raising her drink. And here's to that.
Mies lifted hers as well, and the two women drank deep. Then Mies bent forward.
Any word of Krupa and the boy?
Ralik shook his head. I may not be here when they come back, he said. Tell Murillo to go ahead if I don't show, and if other events occur. And if that happens, tell him our man's eyes are open.
Ralic filled his tankard and drained it immediately. Then he rose.
Don't wish me luck, he said.
How about success?
Mies asked, a worried expression on her broad face. Ralic jerked his head in a nod. Then he left the inn. Anamanda Rake was hiding something. Baruch was certain of it as he stared moodily into the fireplace. In his right hand was a goblet of goat's milk, and in his left, a large fragment of Daru flatbread. Why had the Tista Andi permitted the Imas to enter the barrow? He had asked that question already of the Lord sitting beside him, but an answer didn't seem forthcoming. Instead, all the alchemist got from Rake was that irritating smugness. Baruch took a bite from the flatbread, the crack loud between them. Rake stretched out his legs and sighed.
An odd hour to dine, he said.
All my hours have been odd lately, Baruch said, around the bread. He drank a mouthful of milk.
I'd no idea that both the Shadow Lord and Opon had become involved in affairs, Rake said.
Baruch felt the Lord's eyes on him, but he remained staring at the fire.
I had an intimation of Opon, he said, but nothing definite.
Rake snorted in reply. Baruch downed some more milk.
You hold your hunches close to your chest. I do the same. This avails us nothing, Rake snapped.
The alchemist turned in his chair to face the Tista Andi'i.
Your ravens watched that woman and the Talan Imas enter the barrow. Do you still believe they will fail? Do you?
Rake retorted.
I seem to recall that that was your position on the matter, Baruch. As far as I was and am concerned, I don't much care whether they succeed or not. Either way, there'll be a fight. I suspect you'd imagined there would be a way to avoid one. Obviously, your intelligence concerning the Malazan Empire is sorely lacking. Lassine knows only one thing, and that's force. She'll ignore power until it's unveiled, and then she'll hit you with everything at her disposal.
And you just wait for it to happen? Baruch scowled. That's how cities are destroyed. That's how thousands of people die. Does any of that matter to you, Anamanda Rake? So long as you win in the end?
A tight smile played on the Lord's thin lips.
An accurate assessment, Baruch. In this case, however, Lassine wants Darujistan intact. I mean to prevent that. But destroying the city to defy her would be too easy. I could have managed that weeks ago. No, I want Darujistan to remain as it is, yet out of Lassine's reach. That, alchemist, is victory.
His grey eyes were on Baruch.
I would not have sought an alliance with you otherwise.
The alchemist frowned.
Unless you plan treachery.
Rake was silent for a time, studying his hands clasped on his lap.
Baruch, he said softly, as any commander of long standing knows, treachery breeds its own. Once committed, whether against an enemy or an ally, it becomes a legitimate choice for everyone in your command, from the lowest private seeking promotion to your personal aides, bodyguards, and officers. My people know of our alliance with you, alchemist. If I were to betray it, I would not long remain the Lord of Moonspawn. And rightly so.
Baruch smiled.
And who would challenge your power, Rake?
Caladan Brood, for one, Rake replied immediately. And then there's my four assassin mages. Even Silana, the dweller within the moon's caverns, might take it upon herself to exact judgment on me. I can think of others, Baruch. Many others.
So, fear holds you in check, son of darkness.
Rake scowled. That title is held by those fools who think me worthy of worship. I dislike it, Baruch, and would not hear it again from you. Does fear hold me in check? No. As powerful as fear is, it is no match for what compels me. Duty.
The Lord's eyes had shifted into a dun tone as they remained fixed on his hands, which he now turned palms up.
You have a duty to your city, Baruch. It drives you, shapes you. I'm no stranger to such a thing. Within Moonsworn are the last of the Tista Andii on this world. We are dying, alchemist. No cause seems great enough to return to my people the zest for life. I try, but inspiration has never been a great talent of mine. Even this Malazan Empire could not make us rise to defend ourselves, until we ran out of places to run to. We still die on this continent. Better that it be by the sword.
He let his hand slip from his lap.
Imagine your spirit dying while your body lives on. Not for 10 years, not for 50, but a body that lives on for 15, 20,000 years.
Rake rose swiftly. He looked down upon a silent Baruch and smiled a smile that launched a dagger of pain into the alchemist's heart.
Thus duty holds me, yet a duty that is in itself hollow. Is it enough to preserve the Tista Andii? Simply preserve them? Do I raise Moonspawn into the heavens, where we live on, beyond any risk, any threat? What, then, will I be preserving? A history, a particular point of view.
He shrugged.
The history is done, Baruch, and the Tista Andii point of view is one of disinterest, stoicism, and quiet, empty despair. Are these gifts to the world worthy of preservation? I think not.
Baruch had no immediate response. What Anamanda Rake had described was almost beyond comprehension, yet its anguished cry reached through to the alchemist.
And yet, he said, here you are, allied with the Empire's victims. Do you stand alone in this, Anamanda Rake? Do your people approve?
They care not, Rake said. They accept my commands. They follow me. They serve Caladan Brood when I ask them to. And they die in the mud and forests of a land that is not their own, in a war not their own, for a people who are terrified of them.
Baruch sat forward.
Then why? Why do you do all this?
A harsh laugh was Rake's response. After a moment, however, his bitter amusement fell away and he said,
Is an honorable cause worth anything these days? Does it matter that we've borrowed it? We fight as well as any man. We die alongside them. Mercenaries of the spirit. And even that is a coin we scarcely value. Why? It doesn't matter why. But we never betray our allies. I know you are worried that I did nothing to prevent the Talan Imas from entering the barrow.
I believe the Jaghat tyrant will be freed, Baruch. But better now, with me here beside you, than at some other time, when the Jaghat has no one capable of opposing him. We'll take this legend and carve the life from it, alchemist, and never again will the threat haunt you.
Baruch stared at the Tista Andi. Are you certain that you'll be able to destroy the Jaghat?
No, but when it is finished with us, it will have been much reduced. Then it falls to others, to your cabal, in fact. There's no certainty in this, Baruch. That seems a fact particularly galling to you humans. You'd better learn to accept it. We may well be able to destroy the Jaghat tyrant, but even this will serve Lassine's plans.
The alchemist was bemused. I don't understand. Rake grinned.
When we are finished with it, we will have been much reduced. And then will come the powers of the Malazan Empire. So, you see, either way, she wins. If anything has her worried, it's your Torud cabal, Baruch. Of your abilities, she knows nothing. Which is why her agents seek this Vorkan. The guildmaster accepting the contract will solve the problem you represent.
Yet, Baruch mused, there are other factors involved.
Opon, Rake stated, that is a danger to everyone involved. Do you think Opon cares for a mortal city? For its people? It is the nexus of power that matters to Opon, the whirlwind where games get nasty. Will immortal blood be spilled? That's the question the gods are eager to have answered.
Baruch stared down at his goblet of goat's milk.
Well, at least we've avoided that so far.
He took a sip.
Wrong, Rake said. Forcing Shadow Throne out of the game marked the first spilling of immortal blood.
Baruch almost choked on the milk. He set down the goblet and stared up at the Tista Andi.
Whose? Two hounds died by my sword. Knocked Shadow Throne somewhat off balance, I believe.
Baruch leaned back and closed his eyes.
Then the stakes have risen. He said.
As far as Moonspawn, alchemist.
Rake returned to his chair and sat, once again stretching his legs out to the fire's warmth.
Now, what more can you tell me about this Jaghat tyrant? I recall you said you wished to consult an authority.
Baruch opened his eyes and tossed the flatbread into the fire.
There's a problem there, Rake. I'm hoping you can help explain what's happened. Please, he said, rising. Follow me.
Grunting, Rake climbed back to his feet. This night he'd not worn his sword. To Baruch, the Lord's broad back looked incomplete, but he was thankful for the weapon's absence. He led Rake from the room and down the central stairs to the lower chambers. The first of these subterranean rooms held a narrow cot, and on the cot lay an old man. Baruch indicated him.
As you see, he appears to be sleeping. He is named Mamet.
Rake raised an eyebrow.
The historian.
Also a high priest of Drek.
That explains the cynicism in his writings, Rake said, grinning. The worm of autumn breeds an unhappy lot.
Baruch was surprised that this Tista Andi had read Mamet's histories. But then, why not? A life spanning 20,000 years necessitated hobbies, he supposed.
So, Rake said, striding to the bed, this
Mammoth sleeps a deep sleep.
What triggered it?
He crouched before the old man. Baruch joined him.
That is the odd part. I admit to knowing little of earth magic. Driss is a warren I've never explored. I called on Mammoth, as I indicated to you, and upon his arrival, I asked him to tell me all he knew of the Jaghut Tyrant and the Barrow. He promptly sat down and closed his eyes. They've yet to open, and he's not uttered a single word since.
Reg straightened.
He took your request seriously, I see.
What do you mean?
As you guessed, he opened his Driss warren. He sought to answer your question by rather, shall we say, direct means. And now something's trapped him.
He travelled by warren to the Jaghut Tyrant's barrow? The old fool.
Into a concentration of Telan's sorcery, not to mention Jaghut Omto's Velak. On top of all that, a woman with an Oteterol sword.
Rake crossed his arms.
He'll not come round until both the Talan Imas and the Oteterol have left the barrow. And even then, if he's not quick, the awakening Jaghut might take him.
A chill burgeoned in Baruch's bones. Take, as in possession?
Rake nodded, his expression grim.
A high priest, is he? The Jaghut would find him very useful. Not to mention the access Mammoth provides to Drek. Do you know, Baruch, if this tyrant's capable of enslaving a goddess?
I don't know,
Baruch whispered, sweat trickling down his round face as he stared at Mammoth's recumbent form.
Decembre Fend, he added.
The old woman sitting on the tenement steps squinted at the late afternoon sky while she tamped dried Italba leaves into her steatite pipe. On the wooden steps beside her was a small covered bronze brazier. Thin kindling sticks jutted from holes around the bowl. The old woman withdrew one and set it to her pipe, then tossed it into the street. The man walking down the opposite side of the street caught the signal and ran a hand through his hair. Circle Breaker felt near to panic. This taking to the streets was far too risky. Turban Orr's hunters were close to him. He could feel it with dread certainty. Sooner or later, the councilman would recall his many meetings beneath Despot's barbican, and the guard who'd been stationed there every time. This brazen showing of himself compromised everything. He turned a corner, passing beyond the old woman's sight, and continued for 3 blocks until he came opposite the Phoenix Inn. 2 women lounged by the door, laughing at some joke between them. Circle Breaker tucked his thumbs into his sword belt and angled the scabbard out to the side. Its bronze-capped ends scraped against the stone wall beside him. Then he withdrew his hands and continued on his way toward Lakefront.
Well, it's done.
All that remained for him was 1 final contact, possibly redundant, but he would follow the eel's orders. Things were coming to a head. He did not expect to live much longer, but he'd do what he must until that time. What more could be asked of him? At the entrance of the Phoenix Inn, Mies nudged Irilta.
That's it,
she muttered.
You do the backup this time. Usual pattern.
Irilta scowled, then nodded.
Head off, then.
Mies descended the steps and turned up the street. She reversed the route taken by Circle Breaker until she reached the tenement. She saw the old woman still sitting there, lazily watching passers-by. As Mies passed through her line of vision, the old woman removed the pipe from her mouth and tapped it against the heel of her shoe. Sparks rained onto the cobbles. That was the signal. Mies came to the corner of the block, then turned right and entered the alley running the building's length. A door opened for her a third of the way down, and she strode into a dimly lit room with an open door beyond. Someone hid behind the first door, but she did not acknowledge that someone's presence. She passed through the second, inner door, and found herself in a hallway. From there, it was a quick jog up the stairs. Apsalar, all sorry, as she had been known before, hadn't been much impressed by her first sight of Darujistan. For some reason, despite her excitement and anticipation, it had all seemed too familiar. Disappointed, Crocus had wasted no time in taking her to his uncle's home once they'd stabled Cole's horse. The journey to the city, and then through its crowded streets, had been, for Crocus, a continual storm of confusion. This woman seemed to have a knack for catching him off guard, and all he desired now was to throw her into someone else's lap and be done with it. Yet, if that was truly the case, why did he feel so miserable about it? Crocus left Mammoth's library and returned to the outer room. Moby chirped and stuck out its red tongue at him from Mammoth's desk. Ignoring the creature, Crocus stood before Absalom, who had seated herself in the better of the two chairs. His chair, of course.
I don't understand. From the looks of it, he's been gone for a couple of days, at least. So? Is that so unusual?
Apsalar asked casually.
It is, he grumbled. Did you feed Moby, as I asked?
She nodded.
The grapes?
Yes. He placed his hands on his hips.
Strange. Maybe Ralik knows something about it. Who's Ralik?
An assassin friend, Crocus replied distractedly. Apsalar shot to her feet, her eyes wide.
What's wrong?
Crocus asked, stepping close. The girl looked positively terrified. He glared around, half expecting to see some demon rise out of the floor or the cupboard, but the room was unchanged. A little messier than usual, though. Moby's fault, he assumed.
I'm not sure, she said, relaxing with an effort. It was as if I was about to remember something, but it never came.
Oh, Crocus said. Well, we could... A knock sounded on the door. Crocus brightened, walking over to it.
Oh, he probably lost his keys or something, he said. It was unlocked,
Absalar pointed out. Crocus opened the door.
Mies, what you... Quiet!
The big woman hissed, pushing past him and shutting the door. Her gaze fell on Apsalar and her eyes widened. Then she turned back to Crocus.
Good I found you, lad. You see no one since getting back?
Why, no. That's just it.
A stabler,
Apsalar said, frowning up at Mies.
Have we met?
She's lost her memory, Crocus explained. But yes, we stabled Cole's horse.
Why?
Mies demanded. Then as Crocus was about to elaborate, she went on,
Never mind. The stabler shouldn't prove a problem. Well, we're in luck.
Damn it, Mies, Crocus said. What's going on? She met his eyes.
That Darlgard you killed the other night. The one in the garden. They've got your name and description, lad. Don't ask me how. But the dolls are talking high gallows when you're caught.
The blood left Crocus's face. Then his head jerked to Absalar. He opened his mouth, then shut it again. No, she truly didn't remember. But it must have been her. He collapsed into Mammoth's chair.
We've got to hide you, lad,
Mies said.
Both of you, I guess. But don't you worry, Crocus. Me and Arilter, we'll take care of you till something can be worked out. I don't believe this,
he whispered, staring at the wall opposite him.
She betrayed me. Damn her!
Mies looked questioningly at Apsalar, who said,
It's a guess, but I'd say a girl named Chalice.
Mies closed her eyes briefly.
Shelley's Darl. The court's honey these days.
Compassion softened her face, and she looked down on Crocus.
Oh, lad, that's the way of it, then.
He jerked in the seat and glared up at her.
It isn't any more.
Mies grinned.
Right. For now,
she said, arms folded over her chest,
we just sit tight till night. Then it's the rooftops for us. Don't worry. We'll handle things, lad.
Absalar rose.
My name's Absalar, she said. Pleased to meet you, Mies. And thank you for helping Crocus. Absalar, huh? Well,
her grin broadened.
Guess the rooftops will be no problem for you, then. None,
she replied, knowing somehow that she was right in this.
Good enough,
Mies said.
Now, how about we find something to drink?
Mies,
Crocus asked,
do you know where my uncle might have gone? Can't help you there, lad. No idea.
She wasn't sure about the old woman on the steps, but the one immediately below, tucked into a shadowed niche and steadily watching the tenement building, that one would have to be taken care of. It seemed that this coin-bearer had protection. Serat was not unduly concerned. Next to her lord, Anamanda Rake, she ranked the deadliest among the Tista Andi of Moonspawn. Finding this boy servant of Opon's had not proved difficult. Once her lord had given her the necessary details, Opon's magical signature had been easy to find. It helped that she'd encountered it before, and from this very boy, on the rooftops 2 weeks past. Her agents had chased the coin-bearer that night, abandoning him once he'd entered the Phoenix Inn, but only at her command. If she suspected then what she now knew, Opon's presence would have ended that very night. Ill luck, Serat smiled to herself, taking a more comfortable position on the rooftop. They'd move at night, she suspected. As for the woman hiding below, she would have to be removed. Indeed, with a spell of blurring and enough in the way of shadows, she might as easily take the woman's place. There'd be no suspicion from the other woman then, the one presently inside with the coin-bearer. Serat nodded. Yes, that would be how she'd play it. But for now, she'd wait. Patience ever rewards.
Well, Murillo said as he scanned the crowd, they're not here, which means they're with Mammoth.
Crupper drew a deep breath of the sweaty, smoky air.
Ah, civilization. Crupper believes your assessment is accurate, friend. If so, then we might as well rest here drinking and supping for an hour or two.
With that, he strode into the Phoenix Inn. A few old hands, seated at Crupper's table, gathered their tankards and pitcher and left, murmuring apologies and grinning among themselves. Crupper gave them a gracious nod and settled with a loud sigh into his usual chair. Murillo paused at the bar and spoke with Skurve. Then he joined Crupper. Brushing dust from his shirt, Murillo frowned distractedly at his road-weary condition.
I look forward to a bath, he said. Apparently Skurve saw Ralik in here earlier, talking with some stranger. Since then, nobody's seen him.
Crupper waved an uninterested hand.
Kind Salty arrives, he announced.
A moment later, a pitcher of ale stood on the table. Crupper wiped his tankard with his silk handkerchief, then filled it with the foaming brew.
Weren't we supposed to report to Baruch?
Murillo asked, his eyes on his friend.
All in due time, Crupper said. First, we must recover from our ordeals. What if Crupper were to lose his voice in very mid-sentence of said report? What would avail Baruch of that?
He raised his tankard and drank deep. Murillo drummed the fingers of one hand restlessly on the table, his eyes constantly scanning the crowd. Then he straightened in his seat. He filled his tankard.
So, now that you know what Ralik and I are up to, he said, What do you plan to do about it?
Crupper's eyebrows lifted.
Crupper? Why, nothing but good, of course. Timely assistance and such. No need for blatant fretting, friend Murillo. By all means proceed as planned. Think of wise Crupper as no more than a kindly chaperone.
Hood's breath, Murillo groaned, eyes rolling. We were doing fine without your help. The best thing you could do for us is stay out of our way. Don't get involved.
And abandon my friends to the fates? Nonsense!
Murillo finished his ale and rose. I'm going home, he said.
You can make the report to Baruch in a week's time for all I care. And when Relic finds out you know all about our plans, well, Crupper, I'd hate to be in your boots.
Crupper waved dismissively.
See, Salty Yawn! Upon her tray is Crupper's supper. Relic Nom's nasty daggers and nastier temper pale to insignificance before such repast as now approaches. Good night to you, then, Murillo. Until the morrow.
Murillo stared down at him, then grumbled.
Good night, Crupper.
He left the bar through the kitchen door. As soon as he stepped into the back alley, a figure accosted him from across the way. Murillo frowned.
That you, Relic?
No,
the shadowed figure said.
Fear me not, Murillo. I have a message to you from the eel. Call me Circle Breaker.
The man strode closer.
The message concerns Councilman Turban Orr.
Ralik moved from rooftop to rooftop in the darkness. The need for absolute silence slowed his hunt considerably. There'd be no conversation with Ocelot. Ralik expected he'd have but one shot at the man. If he missed his chance, his clan leader's sorcery would provide the deciding factor. Unless... Ralik paused and checked his pouch. Years back, the alchemist Baruch had rewarded him for work well done with a small bag of reddish dust. Baruch had explained its magic-deadening properties, but Ralik resisted placing his trust in the powder. Had its potency survived the years? Was it a match for Ocelot's powers? There was no telling. He crossed a high rooftop, skirting the edge of a dome. Off to his right and below was the city's eastern wall. The faint glow of Warritown rose beyond it. The assassin suspected that Ocelot would await Cole's arrival at Warri Gate, hiding within crossbow range. Better to kill the man before he entered the city. This limited the possibilities considerably. Lines of sight were few, and Kral's Hill was the best of them. Still, Ocelot might well have used sorcery already, and lie hidden from mundane eyes. Ralik might stumble right over him. He reached the north side of the dome's skirt. Before him rose the Krull Temple. From the belfry, there'd be a clean shot just as Cole entered the gate. Ralik removed the pouch from his bag. Whatever the dust covered, Baruch had said, would be impervious to magic. More, it had an area effect. The assassin scowled. How much of an area? And did it wear off? Most importantly, Baruch had said, and Ralik remembered this clearly, do not let it touch your skin. Poison? He had asked. No, the alchemist had replied. The powder changes some people. There is no predicting such changes, however. Best not to take the chance, Ralik. Sweat trickled down his face. Finding Ocelot was already a slim chance. Cole's death would ruin everything, and more, it would strip from Ralik his last claim. To what? To humanity. The price of failure had become very high. Justice, he hissed angrily. It has to mean something. It has to. Ralik untied the pouch. He dipped into it and scraped out a handful of the powder. He rubbed it between his fingers. It felt like rust.
That's it?
He wondered. Maybe it had deteriorated. Shrugging, he began to massage it into his skin, starting with his face.
What changes?
He muttered.
I don't feel any changes.
Reaching under his clothing as much as was possible, Ralik used up the last of the powder. The pouch itself was stained on the inside. He turned it inside out, then stuffed it into his belt. Now, he grimaced, the hunt continues. Somewhere out there, an assassin waited, eyes fixed on Jamet's Worry Road.
I'll find you, Ocelot,
he whispered, his eyes fixed on Kral's belfry tower.
And magic or no magic, you won't hear me. You won't even feel my breath on your neck until it's too late. I swear it.
He began his ascent.
Chapter 18. This blue city hides under its cloak, a hidden hand that holds like stone, a blade envenomed by the eight-limbed Parolt. The sting brings death in the span of grief that marks a final breath. So this hand defies sorcery's web and trembles the gossamer strand of a spider's deadly threat. This hand beneath the blue city's cloak drives home power's gentle balance. The Conspiracy. Blind Galan. Born 1078. Sergeant Whiskey Jack strode to the bedside.
You're sure you're up to it? He asked Kalam.
The assassin, sitting with his back against the wall, glanced up from honing his long knives.
Not much choice, is there?
He returned to his sharpening. Whiskey Jack's expression was drawn and haggard from lack of sleep. He looked across the small room to where Quick Ben crouched in a corner. A fragment of bedroll was clutched in the wizard's hands, and his eyes were closed. At the table, Fiddler and Hedge had dismantled their massive arbalest. They now sat cleaning and examining each piece. They were looking at a fight ahead of them. Whiskey Jack shared their conviction. Each hour that passed brought their many hunters that much closer. Of those, it was the Tista Andi he feared the most. His squad was good, but not that good. By the window was Trotz, leaning against the wall with his burly arms crossed. And against one wall slept Mallet, his snores loud in the room. The sergeant returned his attention to Kalam.
It's a long shot, isn't it?
The assassin nodded.
No reason for the man to keep showing himself. They got burned the last time.
He shrugged.
I'll try the inn again. If anything, someone will mark me, and the guild will come. If I can get a word in before they kill me, there's a chance. It's not much.
But it'll have to do,
Whiskey Jack finished.
You got tomorrow. If we draw a blank,
he looked over to Fiddler and Hedge and found their eyes on him.
We detonate the intersections. Do damage. Hurt them.
The two saboteurs grinned their anticipation. Quick Ben's loud hiss of frustration brought everyone round. The wizard's eyes had opened. He tossed the torn cloth contemptuously onto the floor.
No, good sergeant, he said. Can't find sorry anywhere.
Kalam rumbled a curse and thrust his weapons into their scabbards.
So, what does that mean?
Whiskey Jack asked the wizard.
Most likely, Quick Ben said. She's dead.
He gestured at the cloth.
With that, there's no way the rope could hide from me. Not while still possessing sorry. Maybe once you told him, you'd figured him out,
Fiddler said.
He tossed in his coins and quit the game.
Quick Ben made a face.
The rope isn't scared of us, Fiddler. Come back to Earth. If anything, he'd be coming down on us. Shadow Throne must have told him by now who I am, or, rather, who I once was. It's not the rope's business, but Shadow Throne might insist. Gods don't like being cheated, especially being cheated twice.
He climbed to his feet and stretched the kinks from his back. He met Whiskey Jack's gaze.
I don't understand this, Sergeant. I'm stumped.
Do we abandon her?
Whiskey Jack asked. Quick Ben nodded.
Might as well.
He paused and stepped forward.
We were all wishing we were wrong about her, he said. But what Sorry did had nothing to do with being human. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad of that.
I'd hate to think, Kalam said from the bed, that evil was real, that it existed with a face as plain as the next man's. I know, Whiskey Jack, you've got your reasons for wanting it that way.
Quick Ben moved closer to the sergeant, his gaze softening.
Keeps you sane every time you order somebody to die, he said. We all know about that, Sergeant, and we'd be the last to suggest there's some other way that maybe you haven't thought of yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, Whiskey Jack growled.
He surveyed everyone in the room, seeing that Mallet was awake and watching him.
Anybody else got something to say?
I have,
Fiddler said, then ducked at the sergeant's glower.
Well, you asked, didn't you?
Out with it, then.
Fiddler straightened in his chair and cleared his throat. Hedge poked him in the ribs as he was about to begin. After a menacing scowl, he tried again.
It's like this, Sergeant. We've seen a lot of our friends die, right? And maybe we didn't have to give the orders, so maybe you think it's easier for us. But I don't think so. You see, to us, those people were living, breathing. They were friends. When they die, it hurts. But you go around telling yourself that the only way to keep from going mad is to take all that away from them, so you don't have to think about it, so you don't have to feel anything when they die. But, damn, when you take away everybody else's humanity, you take away your own. And that'll drive you mad as sure as anything. It's that hurt we feel that makes us keep going, Sergeant. And maybe we're not getting anywhere, but at least we're not running away from anything.
There was silence in the room. Then Hedge punched Fiddler in the arm.
Don't be damned. You've got a brain in there, after all. I guess I've been wrong about you all these years. Yeah, right,
Fiddler said, rolling his eyes at Mallet.
And who is it who's burned his hair off so many times he's got to wear some ugly leather cap all the time, eh?
Mallet laughed, but the tension remained, and everyone's gaze swung back to fix on their sergeant. Slowly, Whiskey Jack studied each man in his squad. He saw the caring in their eyes, the open offer to the friendship he had spent years suppressing. All that time pushing them away, pushing everyone away, and the stubborn bastard just kept on coming back. So, Sorry hadn't been human. His conviction that all she had done was within the possibilities of humanity now seemed to rest on uncertain ground. But it did not collapse. He had seen too much in his life. There'd be no sudden faith in his view of human history, no burgeoning optimism to chase away all the demonic memories of the horrors he'd lived through. Still, there came a time when some denials lost their function, when the world's relentless battering at him made his foolishness obvious even to himself. He was, finally, and after all these years, among friends. That was a hard admission, and he realized he was already impatient with it.
All right, he growled, enough with the flapping lips. We've got work to do. Corporal?
Sergeant?
Kalam replied.
Get yourself ready. You've got the daylight hours to re-establish contact with the Assassin's Guild. Meanwhile, I want everyone else to lay out their weapons and give them a good cleaning. Repairs to armor. There'll be an inspection. And if I find a single damn thing I don't like, there'll be Hood's Heel coming down. Understood?
We hear you,
Mallet said, grinning. Despite their slow pace, Cole's wound had opened half a dozen times since they'd begun the journey. He had found a way of sitting in his saddle, leaning to one side, and taking most of the weight on his uninjured leg. And since this morning, the wound had yet to reopen. The awkward position brought pains and cramps to the rest of him, however. Paran knew a foul mood when he saw one. Though it was clear to both of them that a bond had formed between them, comfortable and unfettered by pretenses, they had exchanged but scant words as the ravages of Cole's wound continued to take its toll. Cole's entire left leg, from the hip where the sword had done its damage down to the foot, was a uniform, sun-darkened brown color. Clots of drying blood gathered in the joints of his upper leg plates and knee guard. As the thigh swelled, they were forced to slice the leather padding beneath the plate. Succor had been denied them at the Catlin Bridge garrison, since the lone surgeon stationed there had been sleeping off one of his bad nights. Clean bandages had been donated, though, and it was these, already soaked through, that now covered the wound. There was little traffic on Jammet's Worry, despite the city's walls being within sight. The flood of refugees from the north had since ended, and those who would gather for the Gedaron festival had already done so. As they approached the edge of Worry Town, Cole raised himself from the semi-conscious state he had been in for the last few hours. His face was deathly white.
"Is this Worry Gate?"
he asked dully.
"I believe so," Paran said, since they were on the road sharing that strange name.
"Will we be permitted to pass within?" he asked. "Will the guards call for a surgeon?"
Cole shook his head.
"Take me on through Phoenix Inn. Take me to the Phoenix Inn."
His head sagged again.
"Very well, Cole."
He'd be surprised if the guards permitted it, and he'd need a story to tell them, though Cole had said nothing of how he'd been wounded.
"I hope," he muttered, "there's someone in this Phoenix Inn with a healer's touch."
The man looked bad. Paran fixed his gaze on the city's gates. He'd already seen enough to understand why the Empress wanted it so avidly.
"The Rugis Stan," he sighed. "My, but you are a wonder, aren't you?"
Ralik nudged himself another inch upward. His limbs trembled with exhaustion. If not for the morning shadows on this side of the belfry, he'd have been spotted long ago. As it was, he would not remain hidden much longer. Taking the stairs would have been suicide in the darkness. Ocelot would have set alarms all along the way. The man was no fool at covering the approaches to his position. If he was up there, Ralik reminded himself. If not, Cole was in trouble. There was no telling if his friend had arrived at the gates yet, and the silence from the top of the belfry could mean anything. He paused to rest and glanced up. 10 feet to go, the most critical ones yet. He was so tired it was all he could do simply to retain the handholds. The silent approach was now beyond him. His only advantage lay in that Ocelot's concentration would be eastward, while he now climbed the west side of the tower. He drew some deep breaths, then reached for another handhold. Passers-by stopped to watch Paran and Cole move slowly through Worry Town toward the gate. Ignoring them, and the questions they asked, the captain focused his attention on the two guards at the gate itself. They'd spotted him and Cole, and now stood waiting. Reaching the gate, Paran motioned that they would pass through. One guard nodded, while the other walked alongside the captain's horse.
"Your friend needs a surgeon," he said. "If you wait just inside, we can have one here in 5 minutes."
Paran refused the offer.
"We need to find the Phoenix Inn. I'm from the north, never been here before. The man said the Phoenix Inn, so that's where I'm going to take him."
The guard was dubious.
"Be surprised if you'd make it that far. But if that's what you want, the least we can do is to give you an escort."
As they emerged from the gate's shadow,
The other guard cried out in surprise. Perrin held his breath as the man stepped close to Connor.